content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the December 1st, 2025 issue of the New Yorker magazine. What does capitalism really mean, anyway? In a new global history, capitalism is an inescapable vibe, responsible for everything, everywhere, all at once. By Gideon Lewis Krauss. In September 1639, John Winthrop, the governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, recorded in his journal a dreadful tale of Puritan true crime. One Robert Keene had prospered as a London merchant before his emigration to Boston, where he did brisk custom as a shopkeeper and maintained a pious reputation as an ancient professor of the gospel. Now he stood trial for the very evil sale of foreign commodities at prices that exceeded the sum he had paid for them. For the sin of a standard retail markup, he faced excommunication. A tearful Keene bewailed his covetous and corrupt heart, but claimed to have been misled. The situation, the magistrates conceded, was tricky. Profit-taking was not technically illegal, and the just appraisal of goods remained a redoubtable challenge despite the best efforts of wise men. Keene's sentence was commuted to a 200-pound fine and a remedial sermon. Scripture showed that it was a false principle to believe that a man might sell as dear as he can and buy as cheap as he can. 14 years later, Keene devoted his final testament to a 158-page justification of his commercial activities as a service to his community and to God. He wanted his 200 pounds back to be pledged as a donation to Harvard. Sven Beckert, a prize-winning professor of history at Harvard, opens his colossal Capitalism, A Global History, published by Penguin, with the observation that Keene's penchant for arbitrage now appears unexceptional, even natural. In the grand scheme of things, he continues, this attitude has only recently come into vogue, and he was motivated to inquire after its provenance by an urgent sense that we need to understand this almost geological force shaping our lives. There isn't much of a market, Beckert has noticed, for the extended reconsideration of feudalism or of hunting and gathering, but capitalism provokes visceral reactions. Beckert identifies two diametrically opposed stories. Capitalism either deserves credit for the rise in living standards and longevity, or stands condemned as an insatiable demon. His book addresses a deep frustration that so many of the stories we tell about capitalism are incomplete and sometimes just plain wrong. He invites readers to study capitalism with a sense of wonder, surprise, and astonishment, not because it is good or bad, but because of its world-shaping power and because understanding it is crucial to navigating our shared future. In the course of the next 1,100 pages, this sales pitch starts to seem a little disingenuous. By the time Beckert arrives at our neoliberal era, he has given himself over to open lamentation. Everything has been ruthlessly priced, even human reproduction. Dating apps have transformed love and sex into marketable goods, he resurrects hookup culture, a moral panic one no longer hears much about, as a perfect supplement to the neoliberal age. But for Beckert, there's a slippery slope between Keene's shop and the emerging market the historian sees for recordings of our brainwaves. Capitalism draws its energy, he concludes, by drilling ever deeper into our bodies, our minds, and our most intimate social relations, our very humanity. The end game of capitalism, in his account, is a world where almost nothing escaped commodification. Beckert here refers to commodities in the loose, colloquial sense of products that can be bought and sold. But for the most part, he uses the word as the technical term for a tradable good, like grain or copper, that is standardized, fungible, and divisible into arbitrary quantities. Capitalism, a global history, is both a history of the commodity and an example of one. Its substance is homogeneous, uniform, and interchangeable, as if it had been extruded page by page to meet the needs of procurers at any scale. Beckert has evidently assessed the consumer landscape. A sluggish demand for exiges of feudalism, a frothy bubble for tracts that put capitalism in its place, and banked on product market fit. He explicitly frames his own enterprise as a speculative wager, a bet that capitalism's history, all of it, might be understood, if not wholly contained, between two book covers. If his competitor's merchandise is defective, it is because the attempt to tie capitalism to any monocausal explanation, any fragment, an institution, a technology, a nation, does not explain much. Beckert believes that capitalism cannot be reduced to a discrete essence. It has neither a fixed origin nor a fixed trajectory. It is compatible with a variety of forms of political and social life, and it is never the same from place to place or moment to moment. It is not the work of single actors, but the nexus of all human action. One might wonder, Beckert allows, whether it's worth retaining a concept subject to so much drift. And yet, he takes the fact that the word capitalism exists as an indication that it must refer to something. But how to provide a working definition while eschewing static, essentializing, excessively abstract, or presentist approaches? His solution is to return with one hand what he has taken away with the other. Capitalism has no trans-historical direction, but it nevertheless embodies a unique logic, the tendency to grow, flow, and permeate all areas of activity was age-old, an essential, irreducible quality of capitalism. Capitalism has no essence, except, actually, its essence was a globe-spanning creep that produced a connected diversity. It is the manifestation of ravenous appetite. What Beckert exemplifies here is how capitalism very often functions in the academic humanities, as a way to show that the world's evils, imperialism, colonialism, racism, sexism, inequality, exploitation, extraction, climate change, social media, dating apps, insomnia, a general feeling of unremitting pressure, are not only evil in their own right, but the franchises of a singularly evil phenomenon. Social media sophisticates, who offhandedly blame capitalism, or more urbanely, late capitalism, for all that ails us, might nevertheless hesitate to take their experience as part of a story that runs through 1980s Japan, 1970s Sweden, 1950s Detroit, 19th century Manchester, 18th century Barbados, and 17th century Java. That's a challenge Beckert takes up. When he speaks of capitalism's connected diversity, he is suggesting that any apparent differences are merely the local epiphenomena of capitalist cunning. The book's colonial era prelude, he notes, precedes the coinage of capitalism by a few hundred years. But his story properly begins even earlier, with the 12th century Yemeni port of Aden. It was, he writes, quite literally a fortified node of capital, an island of capitalists, where Jewish, Muslim, and Hindu merchants linked the medieval Arab world with India. Their métier was neither production nor cultivation, but acquisition and exchange. Although trade itself, Beckert grants, was ancient, it had long been reined in by the norms and customs of local participants. In pre-capitalist societies, he continues, decent folk were apparently content to reap what they had sown. He reckons that producing for one's own use was timeless. and it was the birthright of elites to expropriate any surplus. Considerable wealth may have accrued to these chieftains and warlords, but Beckert argues that, in contrast with the workings of capitalism, their reshuffling of resources was candid and legible. Even genocidal larceny, in his account, was carried out in harmony with the prevailing ethos of use. The nomadic conqueror, Timur, ransacked Central Asia, but he devoted his plunder to the construction of magnificent mosques and madrasas, and making his methods essentially different from capital owners. For Beckert, merchants like those of Aden, who used their resources only as a means to capture further resources, were a categorically different breed. In the next few hundred years, these merchant communities expanded around the globe. Unlike earlier traders, who undertook arduous journeys to far-flung depots, such merchants stayed home and put flexible, fungible capital to work in the marketplace. Without ties to land or custom, they embodied the logic of ever-continuing expansion, guided by the truly exotic principle of accumulation for its own sake. These alien values entrenched themselves, Beckert writes, because capital wielded a truly extraordinary development of self-mystification, a power he compares to rogue artificial intelligence. Long-distance traders exposed themselves to considerable risk, where neighbors might be bound by reciprocal obligation, foreigners were not. And so this burgeoning merchant class formed tight-knit communities out of business necessity. Some of them were able to leverage existing social infrastructure. The letters of Aden's Jewish traders, Beckert reports, show a sophisticated system for extending credit and sharing risk that was predicated largely on ties of kinship and personal repute. Such professional strangers, whose primary loyalty was to the incorporeal realm of pure commerce, aroused suspicion by commoners and elites alike. Certainly, there's a long and distinguished tradition of associating Jewish Aravistas with entrepreneurialism, avarice, and clannishness. The Jewish question was a preoccupation of Karl Marx's. What is the worldly religion of the Jew? Huckstering. What is its worldly god? Money. And Jewry played an important role in the opening volume of the German scholar Werner Sombart's vast study, Modern Capitalism, which appeared in 1902 and was the first major book to grapple with something called capitalism as such. Sombart, who saw a racial predisposition at work, would also coin the term late capitalism. In Beckert's view, the arguably parasitical activity of capital-rich traders in the quantitative service of unprecedented accumulation made them seedlings of a qualitatively different world. This new dawn arrived around the 16th century, when economic life was on the verge of its most dramatic shape-shift since the advent of sedentary agriculture. He dubs this period, when it became plausible to describe economic activity in planetary terms, the Great Connecting. What he sees emerging is what Emanuel Wallerstein in the 1970s called the world system. In Wallerstein's scheme, a globalized economy with a division of labor between a productive core and an exploited periphery wasn't just capitalism's hothouse, it was capitalism. World systems theory was controversial. The institutional and economic structures of the Great Connecting Era, colonial monopolies, charter operations, fiscal military states, protectionism, have conventionally been gathered under the banner of mercantilism. Capitalism, in contrast, was thought to be about free markets. Beckert, following Wallerstein and the French historian Fernand Braudel, thinks otherwise. Markets had long been a durable feature of a variety of regimes. Capitalism, by contrast, is to be seen as a collusive, state-sponsored attempt to bring markets under control. Capitalists may have congratulated themselves on their ability to predict and hedge against uncertainty, but what they really did was ensure that systemic risk was offloaded to those at the margins. As he did in his 2014 book, Empire of Cotton, Beckert calls this post-feudalist turn war capitalism, using Barbados as a primary exhibit. The Caribbean island had no family-centered subsistence production, no systems of mutual dependence, nothing to prevent its transformation into one giant sugar plantation, wholly administered by the planter class. The trade between the periphery and the core was jury-rigged to favor the latter. In zones like Barbados, laborers were conscripted or enslaved to produce raw materials, sugar, cotton, silver, for export to the core at artificially suppressed prices. In zones like Britain, labor was relatively uncoerced, and stronger institutions protected higher margin activities such as manufacturing and finance. For Wallerstein, these were the necessary and sufficient conditions to render capitalism a self-perpetuating machine. Beckert has taken up the terms of analysis Wallerstein favored, and he is right to point out that the Caribbean was long neglected by Eurocentric historians. But mechanistic accounts, which leave no room for human agency, have gone out of fashion, and so Beckert distances himself from Wallerstein's model. Capitalism, for Beckert, is not a process of whose internal logic determines its eventual outcome. Instead, like everything with a history, capitalism is made by people. As a social historian, Beckert has political and narrative commitments to actor-centered chronicles. He's helped by his sometimes slippery definition of commodities. Where Wallerstein used the word literally to refer to sugar, say, or iron, Beckert takes the plantation economy as ground zero for the grand aspiration to commodify everything. This certainly sounds actor-centered, but it mostly functions as a cosmetic gloss on a story of structural inevitability. What happened in Barbados, he proposes, prototyped the coming capitalist utopia of markets becoming the sole arbiter of human affairs. And so the immense brutality of the Barbadian plantation, in his telling, prefigures contemporary hookup culture. The desire to have it both ways, to genuflect to agency while casting structure as the man behind the curtain, extends to the way Beckert plays with the schemes of historical continuity and rupture. He uses variants of the words radical or unprecedented around 200 times. It's all part of his attempt to denaturalize capitalism, to insist that its persistence was not foreordained. Yet, his metaphors for capitalism are drawn almost exclusively from the natural world, before it broke through the canopy as a tree, with root, trunk, and leaves, it appeared as a sprout and a taproot. When it is not a predatory cuckoo depositing its eggs in the nest of other birds, it is an almost geological force of tectonic strength, not to mention a riverbed, a torrent, a tsunami. Beckert tries to tame the sense of a conceptual free-for-all by partitioning the evolution of capitalism into periods of punctuated equilibrium. The effect is to reduce capitalism to the manic reinvention of the wheel. In the 18th century, for example, merchants pressed the peasantry of the Silesian countryside to increase linen production. This labor mobilization strategy, Beckert observes, was at once old, in fact, at the very heart of European feudalism, and, by dint of its scale, intensity, and focus, a radical innovation. Beckert's shape-shifting capitalism is relentlessly dynamic. As it exhausts the possibilities of one stage, it re-engineers itself for the next. By the middle of the 18th century, a perfect storm gathered, and that unlikely convergence through human history onto a fundamentally new course, with the unprecedented growth of industrial capitalism. This process is rinsed and repeated for reconstructed capitalism and then neoliberalism. Capitalism is rendered as a prisoner of samsara, trapped in an endlessly destructive cycle of death and rebirth. Treating capitalism in general, and industrialization in particular, as a political project obligates Beckert to minimize the role of technology. The Ruckling family, a Saarland dynasty with diversified holdings in what Beckert calls the abyss of heavy industry, is mentioned more than 100 times. James Watt, a pioneer of the steam engine, appears in passing on 3 occasions, introduced not as a successful inventor, but as a tinkerer funded by his sugar trading family. The explosive growth of British cotton mills is customarily attributed to labor-saving innovation driven by high wages. But Beckert argues that, at its heart, the industry's expansion was an example of import substitution industrialization, or the policy of using tariffs and subsidies to protect domestic industries from foreign competition. Britain did enforce aggressive textile tariffs starting in the 1720s. Yet it really was the arrival of technologies like the spinning jenny and the water frame, half a century later, that drove its dominance in textile manufacturing. The mid-20th century strategy of import substitution industrialization was a means for a developing country to try to compensate for a foreign competitor's first-mover advantage. Britain was the first mover, however, and the fact that what happened in Lancashire and not in Guangdong is precisely the sort of thing books like this are supposed to explain. Beckert's habit of downplaying technology leads to some claims that are dubious on their face. How is it that the 19th century saw a nearly threefold increase in the number of clockmaking workshops in the Black Forest? According to Beckert, such intensification of manufacturing arose without significant technical or organizational change. This would have come as a surprise to the German manufacturer Erhard Junghans, who founded an eponymous clockmaking firm in 1861 in his hometown of Schaumburg. With help from his brother, who had spent time working in modernized American workshops, he set out to use new methods of precision processing and design tooling to produce interchangeable parts. The firm steadily expanded into alarm clocks and pocket watches, and by the start of the next century, it had become the world's largest producer of timepieces. But Beckert doesn't want to acknowledge that the clockmaking story had much to do with standardization, evidently because he wants to reserve that phenomenon for the 20th century's new and yet uncharted age of radically reconstructed capitalism. In his view, a version of capitalism in which an alliance of private enterprise and state power protected the interests of its titans was superseded by a regime that, for the first time, really protected the interests of its titans. The crucial difference was the ascent of the administrative class, which he considers the most monumental turning point in the global history of capitalism. Once more, the conceit that capitalism owes its endurance to its flexibility, to what Selina Meyer, the pandering politician in the TV series Veep, advertises with the campaign slogan, "Continuity with Change," devolves into a shell game. The entrepreneurs of industrial capitalism, Beckert claims, had very little sense of the cost and profit structures of their businesses. They did not need to fixate on such numbers because productivity was not yet an important consideration. That would wait for a new specimen of calculating supervisors, conjured up by reconstructed capitalism, who were suddenly empowered with their newfangled statistics. In reality, major enterprises in the early 19th century kept exacting records on input prices, waste rates, and output rates. The culture of industrial measurement and efficiency that you find in Charles Dickens' novels from the 1840s and 50s was not just something the writer dreamed up. Beckert treats the state with the same schematic looseness. In his book, the state is either nefarious or passive, complicit or compliant. John D. Rockefeller's Standard Oil is mentioned as a particularly radical example of capital consolidation. Tellingly, Beckert fails to mention that it was broken up by the vigorous antitrust movement. His pinhole view of both markets and states leaves little room for the more complicated, sometimes antagonistic interplay between them. The same century that saw Standard Oil's dissolution also saw the emergence of modern regulatory institutions and, later, state-managed experiments in growth whose outcomes he barely mentions. In 1990, Beckert notes, almost 38% of the world's population lived on less than about $2 per day. In 2022, only 9% did. One might have thought that China's stewardship of its country's hybrid economy, which lifted approximately 800 million people out of hard-scrabble subsistence, had something to do with it. Beckert hastens to assure us that this development was mainly the result of the country's anti-poverty measures. Any effort to distill capitalism to a fixed essence, Beckert warns, will not explain very much. But to make the concept coextensive with dynamism itself, to depict capitalism, as he does, as an airborne toxic event, shapeless and ever-expanding, is to explain nothing at all. The result is a work that is at once boundless in scope and dully inert. For Beckert, capitalism is an artificial realm constituted by coercion, where autonomy belongs solely to age-old technologies and age-old knowledge. For all his talk of complexity, his actor-centered history allows for only two kinds of actors: those who obey the logic of accumulation and those who refuse it. Child labor in a Manchester factory is diabolical. Child labor on a subsistence farm is helping out around the house. Outside capitalism, there is only resistance, a term he wields with the subtlety of a hashtag. He scarcely distinguishes between a feudal lord's resistance to merchant rivals and an indigenous community's resistance to plantation slavery. When French investors tried to set up plantations in Senegal, native potentates rejected wage labor as a threat to their own system of hereditary servitude. A few pages later, the episode proves among the moments Beckert hails as showing how people in the countryside still exercised some control over their economic and often political lives. This muddle stems from a deeper conceptual problem. Capitalism subsumes other logics into its reproduction, for example, a deeply gendered organization of economic life, feeds on them, and at times even reinvigorates them, Beckert writes. Capitalism rests on and continuously produces spaces of non-accumulation. The claim seems designed to defy refutation. So long as capitalism both draws upon and generates non-capitalist relations, the distinction between capitalist and non-capitalist forms of life collapses. Any space of non-accumulation is just growing room for more capitalism. And if capitalism thrives on accumulation and non-accumulation, stability and crisis, the suspicion grows that we've been sold a story without a subject. Beckert seems not unaware of the problem, which might explain his decision to open with the textbook figure of the devout Puritan. This is the familiar terrain of Max Weber's The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, written in the wake of Werner Sombart's foray into modern capitalism. Sombart took capitalism as not merely a mode of production, but a presiding spiritual temper. He appealed to an innate acquisitive instinct, or Erwerbstreib, that he saw reflected in the entrepreneurial vigor of the Jewish diaspora, prompting Weber's complaint that Sombart was accounting for a historical variable by invoking a human constant. Weber, instead, drafted the Calvinist community as a case study in how the logic of accumulation was internalized and spread. The historian Yuri Slutskin dryly remarked that Weber's Protestants discovered a humorless, dignified way to be Jewish. Calvinists, who had once condemned the pursuit of profit, eventually embraced a vocation as rational actors driven by thrifty self-interest. Their faith in predestination left them in a state of chronic existential dread. Although one's fate was fixed, worldly success could be taken as a sign of divine favor. Robert Kane, by the time he died, had already taken the first steps in this direction. In 1911, Sombart returned with an even more categorical case for ethnic determinism. He now identified Jews as the natural vector of capitalist accumulation itself. Whereas the settled cultivator grew only what his family required, the ancient Hebrews, nomadic herders who had to count their flocks, had a perverse value system that elevated greed to the level of principle. As he puts it, only in the shepherd's calling could the view have become dominant that in economic activities the abstract quantity of commodities matters, not whether they are fit or sufficient for use. Beckert, not otherwise inclined to lavish praise on canonical European theorists, has unusually appreciative things to say about Sombart's perceptiveness and prescience. In a paragraph about the all-encompassing bureaucracy of the technological state, Beckert is at pains to note that IBM machinery helped Germany deport its Jews, and yet over the half-dozen times that Beckert approvingly quotes Sombart, it somehow never comes up that he threw in his lot with the Nazis. But then, Capitalism, A Global History, is effectively a planetary remake of Sombart's own mammoth work, with the acquisitive instinct reformulated as a sort of spirit, an omnipresent vibe responsible for everything, and thus for nothing. Beckert's basic opposition between those who are content with what they have and those who are not floats free of time and history in a metaphysical vacuum. He can count on his reader to fill it in. And now, from the November 12, 2025 online edition of The New Yorker, How the Supreme Court Defines Liberty. Recent memoirs by the justices reveal how a new vision of restraint has led to radical outcomes. By Ruth Marcus. To understand how grudging Amy Coney Barrett's new book is when it comes to revealing personal details, consider that one of the family members the Supreme Court justice most often refers to is a great-grandmother who died 5 years before she was born. On Barrett's desk at home, she recounts in Listening to the Law, she keeps a photograph of her great-grandmother's one-story house where, as a widow during the Great Depression, she raised some of her 13 children and took in other needy relatives. Looking at the photo reminds me of a woman who stretched herself beyond all reasonable capacity. Barrett explains, I'm not sure that I'll be able to manage my life with the same grace that she had, but she motivates me to keep trying. For Barrett, the mother of 7 children, that effort entails setting her alarm for 5 a.m. Our kids get up at 6:30 during the school year, so I start early if I want to accomplish anything on my own to-do list, she writes. This is what passes for disclosure from Barrett. She measures out the details of her life with coffee spoons, careful not to spill. You can almost hear the justice's editor pleading for something, anything, more in return for a reported $2 million advance. It should come as no surprise that Barrett's book disappoints. Of all the genres of unsatisfying nonfiction, books by Supreme Court justices may be at the top of the heap. One subset is the memoir that focuses on the justice's early life, ending before confirmation. Another category is the learned disquisition on the law, as in Justice Neil Gorsuch's A Republic If You Can Keep It, and Justice Stephen Breyer's Reading the Constitution. These, too, fall short of readers' hopes for the simple reason that the authors resist any temptation to rule and tell. They write about their understanding of the law and the judicial processes, but when it comes to their dealings with colleagues, they remain resolutely circumspect. Barrett's book is a mashup of the two forms. Memoir and personal reflection are interlaced with explanations of legal doctrine. The bulk of Listening to the Law consists of unexceptionable explanations of court procedures, the legal system, and the Constitution. Barrett is willing to recite the state of the law, but unwilling to offer any clues about her own views beyond what the public record has already revealed. I'm very careful in the book, and I'm always very, very careful. I apply kind of confirmation hearing rules, Barrett told the Times' Ross Douthat in a podcast interview. Anyone who watched a recent high court confirmation hearing understands the frustration inherent in such a self-imposed limitation. She sticks to the happy talk of Chief Justice John Roberts at his own confirmation hearing about judges as umpires calling balls and strikes. Once a judge is on the bench, she is a United States judge, not a Democrat or Republican office official beholden to a particular administration or party, Barrett writes. The guiding principle in every case is what the law requires, not what aligns with the judge's own concept of justice. Nice words, but they elide how infrequently the identity of the nominating president's political party predicts a justice's vote. The meat of Barrett's book is her defense of originalism, the notion that the Constitution should be interpreted according to the meaning of its language at the time of adoption. The originalist approach was championed during the Reagan administration by the then Attorney General Edwin Meese, who endorsed a jurisprudence of original intention in which the original meaning of constitutional provision and statutes was the only reliable guide for judgment. Any other method, Meese insisted, suffers the defect of pouring new meaning into old words, thus creating new powers and new rights totally at odds with the logic of our Constitution and its commitment to the rule of law. In short, the original intent of originalism was a determination to roll back what Meese and others saw as the jurisprudential excesses of the court under two successive chief justices, Earl Warren and Warren Burger, and Roe v. Wade, the 1973 abortion ruling, was at the top of their hit list. Through the decades, originalism has evolved from an elusive search for original intent, raising the problem of whose intent is to be deduced, to an examination based on text, history, and tradition of the document's original public meaning. Barrett is appropriately modest in her claims about the degree to which adhering to the originalist approach determines the outcome of a case. I'm not an originalist because I think that history yields easy answers or prevents bad judging, she writes. Indeed, Barrett notes, given the complexity of both language and legal problems, we should not be surprised that in difficult cases, judges aiming at the same target, ordinary meaning, sometimes land in different places. Acting in good faith, judges do the best they can with the tools they have. Barrett, like most originalists, insists that the court's 1954 ruling in Brown v. Board of Education can be defended on originalist grounds. The alternative is unthinkable. The drafters and ratifiers of the Equal Protection Clause might have thought that the clause permitted a regime of separate but equal racial segregation, she writes. Tough luck. The commitment to equality controls, not anyone's expectations about how the commitment would apply. But it is hard to square that conclusion, however laudable, with the originalist practice of looking to history and tradition to understand the Constitution's meaning at the time the language was written. When the 14th Amendment was ratified in 1868, as the Harvard legal scholar Michael Klarman has written, African Americans were almost universally excluded from or segregated in public schools. The very Congress that proposed the 14th Amendment in June of 1866 established separate schools for black people in the District of Columbia the next month. Like her fellow originalists, Barrett is particularly unconvincing in her discussion of various rights not expressly mentioned in the Constitution that have been deemed worthy of constitutional protection. These unenumerated rights include the right to marriage, to use contraception, to engage in same-sex intimacy, and, until Dobbs, to abortion. The court has identified the source of such protections in the gauzy language of the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments, which guard against governmental deprivation of liberty without due process of law. Hence, the somewhat oxymoronic term, substantive due process. In an effort to confine the reach of that phrase, the court has increasingly looked to historical practice. In a unanimous 1997 case rejecting a right to assisted suicide, Washington v. Glucksberg, the justices said that an unenumerated right can be deemed fundamental and therefore deserving of the highest degree of constitutional protection. Only if it is deeply rooted in this nation's history and tradition and implicit in the concept of ordered liberty. The majority in Dobbs determined that the right to abortion does not meet that test. As Barrett explains in her book, the evidence does not show that the American people have traditionally considered the right to obtain an abortion so fundamental to liberty that it goes without saying in the Constitution. But Barrett fails to answer the challenge posed by the Dobbs dissenters, how other unenumerated rights manage to pass this test, and what their future holds. Thomas, in a separate concurrence, said that justices should reconsider all of this court's substantive due process precedents, although the court this week rejected a bid to overturn its ruling on same-sex marriage. For Barrett, being parsimonious about declaring that a right is fundamental serves the important purpose of preventing courts from overstepping their constitutional role and imposing their policy views on the country. The court's job, she writes, is to respect the choices that the people have agreed upon, not to tell them what they should agree to. What Barrett's narrow conception of constitutional rights and constitutional interpretation misses, however, is the court's equally essential counter-majoritarian rule, protecting individual liberties and not insisting that they be limited to the norms of a preserved in amber moment, one in which white men held political and economic power, women could not vote, and black people were enslaved. As the dissenters in Dobbs wrote, the framers defined rights in general terms to permit future evolution in their scope and meaning. And over the course of our history, this court has taken up the framers' invitation. A new book by the former Justice Anthony Kennedy, another amalgam of memoir and jurisprudence, serves as a well-timed counterpoint to Barrett's. Even its title, Life, Law, and Liberty, is an unintended retort to Barrett's reluctance to read too much meaning into those deliberately capacious words. Where Barrett's volume suffers from her allergy to disclosing personal details, Kennedy's may be the victim of too much enthusiasm for it. The most engaging part of Kennedy's memoir is his rendition of his 30 years on the High Court, beginning with his selection in 1987. Kennedy, who in the late 80s was serving as a federal appeals court judge, had known Reagan well from his Sacramento days, but he was the president's third choice for the position after the defeat of federal appeals court judge Robert Bork, one of the originalists, and the failed nomination of Bork's colleague on the D.C. Circuit Court, Douglas Ginsburg, after reports that he had smoked marijuana while teaching at Harvard Law School. Kennedy describes his session with Reagan, Meese, and Howard Baker, who had been formerly the Senate Majority Leader and was then Reagan's chief of staff. Throughout the interview, Senator Baker seemed to indicate that he and the president had supported me from the beginning. Ed, now seemingly much relieved and fully on board, gave me a warm hug. But any reservations Meese had about Kennedy were borne out in the ensuing years. The ideological gulf between Bork and Kennedy shaped the nation for the next three decades, until Barrett and the other Trump-appointed justices undid much of Kennedy's work. Certainly, Kennedy was a conservative within the traditional meaning of that term. He was the deciding vote, and he confirms the author of the unsigned opinion in Bush v. Gore, in which the Supreme Court halted the counting of contested ballots in Florida and effectively awarded the 2000 election to George W. Bush. The decision was based on the conclusion that different standards for counting ballots in different Florida counties amounted to a violation of the Equal Protection Clause. Kennedy insists that partisan considerations had nothing to do with the outcome. It was my firm conviction that the court had decided the case in a fair and neutral way, he writes. For that reason, it was disappointing to me that people saw in the decision a split along political lines. But people perceived a political division because there was one. The liberal justices, they included Republican nominees John Paul Stevens and David Souter, voted in Gore's favor, the conservatives in Bush's. Kennedy also provided the fifth vote and wrote the majority opinion in Citizens United, the 2010 case that opened the door to the evisceration of effective limits on campaign contributions. His defense is unconvincing. In these campaign finance cases, the voters are the ones with the true power, he writes. If they see money coming into campaigns from sources they do not like, they can demand disclosure, and they can choose to vote against the candidate. That assessment was unduly rosy, even when Citizens United was decided. Since then, the Brennan Center, a liberal public policy institute, has tallied the total of dark money spending in federal elections at more than $4 billion. But on some of the most contested issues of the day, affirmative action, abortion, and gay rights, Kennedy's presence made all the difference. In the course of two decades, he ushered in protection for gay rights under the rubric of preserving individual dignity. That development began in 1996 with Romer v. Evans, in which the court invalidated an amendment to the Colorado Constitution that had banned protecting gay people from discrimination. A state cannot so deem a class of persons a stranger to its laws, Kennedy opined. It continued in 2003 with Lawrence v. Texas, in which the court overruled its decision 17 years earlier that states could criminalize homosexual conduct. Liberty presumes an autonomy of self that includes freedom of thought, belief, expression, and certain intimate conduct. The instant case involves liberty of the person both in its spatial and more transcendent dimensions, Kennedy wrote in his typical flowery prose. Lawrence begat the 2013 ruling U.S. v. Windsor, which extended federal benefits to same-sex couples married under their state's laws. 2 years later, Obergefell v. Hodges, establishing a constitutional right to same-sex marriage. The nature of injustice is that we may not always see it in our own times, Kennedy wrote. The generations that wrote and ratified the Bill of Rights and the 14th Amendment did not presume to know that the extent of freedom in all its dimensions, and so they entrusted to future generations a charter protecting the right of all persons to enjoy liberty as we learn its meaning. Justice Antonin Scalia responded with a dissent that was slashing even for him. The Supreme Court of the United States has descended from the disciplined legal reasoning of John Marshall and Joseph Story to the mystical aphorisms of a fortune cookie, he wrote. Kennedy was able to shrug it off, Kennedy insists, but my children and their spouses were devastated by the tone of the dissent. He cites Scalia's unkindest cut that the court lacked a genuine Westerner because California does not count. The coda came 7 frosty months later in early February 2016 when, Kennedy writes, Nino said he wanted to visit me. Eventually, their conversation turned to the subject on both our minds, our own relationship. Nino said he had come to regret deeply the tone of his Obergefell dissent and its personal references. He apologized for being intemperate. Scalia told Kennedy that he was about to leave on my last long trip, but asked if the justices and their wives could get together for dinner. Those parting words were the last we ever spoke to each other, Kennedy writes. A little over a week later, his wife Maureen telephoned us around the dinner hour. She had just received word that Nino had died in Texas. Kennedy, in his years on a closely divided court, was routinely identified as a swing justice, a label at which he still bristles. "The cases swung, not me," he writes. That assertion is not entirely accurate. Kennedy shifted over time on abortion, affirmative action, and, as he acknowledges, on the death penalty for juveniles. He upheld the practice in 1989 and voted in 2005 to strike it down. Kennedy is elliptical about his role in Casey v. Planned Parenthood, the 1992 abortion case, writing only that after our conference, the initial discussion and vote the justices take after a case is argued, my colleagues came to know that my own position in Casey was not yet definite. In fact, as Evan Thomas relates in his stellar biography of the late Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, Kennedy initially sided with the other conservative justices, indicating that he would vote to overturn Roe. A month later, after then Chief Justice William Rehnquist had drafted an opinion, Kennedy informed Justice Harry Blackmun, the despondent author of Roe, that he would join forces with O'Connor and Souter to write an opinion preserving the right to an abortion. As Kennedy explains in his book, it is not for judges to rule on the personal morality of a choice, but rather on the permissibility of it under our Constitution. And our Constitution underscores the importance of thoughtful, rational, decent decisions made by individuals and families without interference from the government. Kennedy is more open about the emotional toll of the conflict between his Catholic beliefs and his evolving understanding about what the law requires. Another life is involved, one that cannot speak for itself, Kennedy writes. Because of my ever-constant belief that life must be protected from the moment of conception, I struggled with the idea that the Constitution should allow some choice to end a pregnancy. He debated whether it would be wrong for me, morally, to stay on the court if doing so would require me to rule under the law that women have the right to end a pregnancy in its early pre-viability stage, but concluded that quitting would have been to say that the judicial oath to protect constitutional rights is not binding in difficult or controversial cases. On the morning the Casey decision was issued, Kennedy recalls that he made an apologetic call to his daughter in California, then a 23-year-old investment banker. "Sorry, it's early. I wanted to call about today's decision. This decision and my plurality opinion do not match our personal hopes and dreams and beliefs, but it is my duty and oath to honor the rule of law." Kennedy's moral anguish over abortion has a fascinating parallel in Barrett's book. For Barrett, the tension is between Catholic teaching against the death penalty and her conclusion that capital punishment is constitutional. "The people who adopted the Constitution didn't share my view of the death penalty, and neither do all my fellow citizens today," she writes. Quite the contrary, 27 states authorize capital punishment, as does the federal government. "If I distort the law to make it difficult for them to impose the death penalty, I interfere with the voters' right to self-government." In recent years, pharmaceutical companies have refused to provide drugs for lethal injections, prompting states to use alternate means of execution, and raising the question of whether these new methods violate the constitutional prohibition against cruel and unusual punishments. In October, Barrett voted with her fellow conservatives to permit the execution of an Alabama man, Anthony Boyd, by nitrogen hypoxia, effectively suffocating him, as the liberal justices detailed in a harrowing description. Would affording Boyd the barest form of mercy, as Justice Sotomayor put it, by allowing his request to die by firing squad, really infringe on voters' right to self-government? Barrett, like the other conservative justices, did not explain her decision to reject Boyd's request. Both justices frame their conclusion as a matter of appropriate judicial modesty. Yet it is telling that Barrett's version of restraint leads her to support a politically conservative result and to defer to the will of the majority. Kennedy's model results in an outcome that is politically liberal and elevates individual choice. This difference gets to the most fundamental distinction between the two jurists and the profound shift in the court's jurisprudence in the 7 years since Kennedy's retirement. The bolstered conservative majority, which includes two former Kennedy clerks, Gorsuch and Justice Brett Kavanaugh, has dismantled part of Kennedy's legacy by overturning Roe, effectively abolishing affirmative action, and declaring that the federal courts have no role in preventing partisan gerrymandering. For years, Kennedy had flirted with the notion that judges could supervise and tamp down partisan gerrymandering. Kavanaugh replaced him and provided a fifth vote for the proposition that such mischief, though incompatible with democratic principles, is a political question outside the power of federal courts to resolve. If Kennedy is bothered by these developments, he does not share that disappointment with readers. Instead, he sticks to jurisprudential theory, disclaiming both the pragmatism of liberals such as former Justice Stephen Breyer and the originalism of Barrett and her colleagues. In my view, neither originalism nor untethered pragmatism has such force that the judge should choose one or the other to instruct in every case, he writes. As for originalism, some principles are not necessarily formulated in the words of the Constitution without considering the broader context. The world in the late 1700s was different in many ways, and the questions the court addresses, in the area of technology, for instance, do not always have clear answers. As for pragmatism, it may be too unclear to give helpful guidance, especially since it often is simply a way to implement some other philosophy or reach a certain desired end. This isn't a fully satisfying refutation of the competing methods of constitutional interpretation. For one thing, it does not adequately credit the efforts at self-discipline embodied in Breyer's pragmatic approach, a method that considers constitutional values, purposes, and workability, not just text, as Breyer describes it in Reading the Constitution. And Kennedy's answer fails to recognize the degree to which his own theory inevitably entails applying subjective value judgments to broad phrases. The new primacy of originalism under the sway of Barrett and her fellow conservatives provides the false allure that the court can operate as a disinterested form of artificial intelligence, ChatGPT, set the Colonial Times. But as Barrett herself freely concedes, originalism is not a right answer generator. What she doesn't concede is that it inherently tilts toward a conservative outcome, leaving individual liberties, in particular, frozen in a bygone era. Kennedy's Constitution is a better document, wiser and more flexible, as its creators intended, than the one to which Barrett would consign us. We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.